Hi, this is Chris Weber's cousin, Beth Sloan, and you're listening to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. Guys, it's early April 2024. In early April 2019, my best buddy and I got together, sat on his back porch, and decided what we were going to do for our new conceived idea for a podcast 5 years ago this month. Wow. Boys and girls. And that means that if we were Wham, we would be just about to break up.
That's right. They were kind of a bright, shining star.
There was a plan. They brought the plan to fruition and said, we're done.
That's it.
But boys and girls, we have no intention of being done. I will stay with Jason until the end of time.
Oh, D, you could drag me to hell and back just as long as we're together.
Just wake me up before you go. All right, boys and girls, we are here to talk about Wham. Now, we have already covered George Michael in some detail. We actually covered him our very first season, August of 2020. We re-released that last year, July of 2023, because it was the 35th anniversary of Faith. So if you want to check out a little more history on George Michael, go back and check that episode out. I listened to it.
I listened to it today too.
Yeah, we're like, oh, hey, I didn't remember that. And so it was very helpful. Yep. But it's a great episode. Go back and check it out. We compared Faith to INXS's Kick.
Right.
And today we are covering Wham's Make It Big to Tears for Fears Songs from the Big Chair.
I got my yellow fingerless gloves on. I got my Choose Life shirt on. I got my Nutter shorts on.
I love it when you wear your Nutter shorts.
I got the boom boom in my heart. Let's do this.
Yeah. So we are going to talk about the second release from Wham to give a little bit of history before we get into it. These are a couple of guys who almost weren't anything.
Yeah.
But for Andrew Ridgeley, there would be no George Michael.
That's an absolute fact.
But for George Michael, there would be no Wham. And but for Wham, there would be no George Michael again. Call me good, call
me bad, call me hey, I'll tell you what, if the teacher had not said, will somebody look after the new boy, and Andrew Ridgeley being the only person who raised his hand in their sixth grade class,
12-year-old boys.
There would be no Wham.
12-year-old kids and a little awkward Orios something, Villanobos something.
Penelonis, yeah.
Yeah. Something Greek. It's all Greek to me.
It is all Greek.
But yeah, he showed up, new kid at school, and the teacher said, who would like to volunteer to mentor young
Orios?
Uh-huh. And Andrew Ridgeley raised his hand. They became fast friends, and George was the shy guy. Andrew was the confident, good-looking kid, and George looked up to him, and George was raised in a Greek family. Two generations earlier, his great-grandfather was a shepherd. I mean, that's shepherding the sheep in Greece is what his grandfather was doing.
Sure.
And so his dad worked hard to establish himself in England, in the UK, and established a restaurant and expected him to work in the restaurant, but George, he had a desire to do something more. And his dad said, why would anybody want to listen to you? You can't even sing.
That is the one thing I still cannot buy on this. I just can't believe it.
So when Andrew Ridgeley says, I want to drop out of school and we need to form a band, George said, no, I don't think I can do it. And Andrew said, yes, you can. You can do this.
We're forming a band.
And he's like, my dad really doesn't think I can do this. And he goes, he's wrong. You can do this. Let's do it. And so that's exactly what they did. Two 18, 19-year-old kids drop out of school. They get welfare, and they start writing songs. They had started with a group called The Executives, which had Andrew's brother in it, but they didn't amount to much. That left Andrew and George to form Wham.
I kind of heard the rest of the story on that.
Yeah, tell me.
So I read about half of Andrew Ridgeley's biography yesterday while I was waiting for my car to be fixed. So Andrew was in a band with his brother and some kind of older guys, and they needed a permanent drummer. And so Andrew's like, George has a set of drums. I've seen seen it. And he called him Yogg.
Yeah, Yogg.
The funny story there is that when George was telling him how to pronounce his name, he's saying it's kind of like yogurt, Yorios, right?
Uh-huh.
Yogurt. And so he just started calling him Yogg from that. But so George had a set of drums. Andrew knew that because when he went over to George's house for the first time, he banged on his drums and George was like, don't do that.
Did you play my drums? No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Touch my drums. But they had very strict guidelines of when he could hit the drums in his house and when he could not. And Andrew just was banging away. But anyway, so they needed a drummer for this band. And so Andrew's like, well, my friend Yogg, he's got a drum set. Let's bring him in. They brought him in. They're like, nah, nope, not going to cut it. And so that's when Andrew's like, screw you guys, I'm out.
Serendipitous.
Very serendipitous, yes. He said that day, we are starting our own band.
Guess what, guys? We're here to talk to you about a rap group.
Hey, everybody, take a look at me. I've got street credibility. I may not have a job, but I have a good time with the boys that I meet down.
Hey, we talked about this in our Faith episode. Wham! / George Michael has been successful singing rap, gospel, R&B, pop, rock,
funk,
dance,
jazz, everything.
No
everything.
Doubt about it.
Yeah. Everything.
It's incredible.
But he started as a rapper.
Well, folks will be a drag if work in your bag, and when you let them know.
So their original music, big song that they thought was going to make them, they called Wham Rap. It was released as a single. It didn't do especially well.
Right.
They had signed a contract, a record recording contract with Intervision at that point. So this is the way that we can become musicians. This is what we've got to do to make a record. So they signed with Intervision, released Wham Rap. It didn't do very well. And then they had another song called Young Guns. Now, this was kind of their make it or break it song. This was the, you know, hey, if this doesn't go anywhere, we're going to have to cut you guys loose. And what happened was Young Guns started moving its way up the chart. It got up to 42.
Yep.
And it stalled.
Yep. And it was really critical that they get into the top 40.
Yep. And there it is, just hovering right outside the top 40 and not moving for weeks. And George, I mean, he's depressed. He is sitting alone in their tiny little apartment thinking, maybe I was wrong about everything. Maybe I'm not a musician. Maybe this isn't what is for me. And then serendipity.
Another huge serendipitous moment.
Top of the Pops. Now, I mean, for those in America not familiar with the British music scene, this is like American Bandstand.
Right.
This is like Dick Clark calls you on the phone.
Right.
Right? And so Top of the Pops calls them. They've got a nearly top 40 hit. I don't know how they're on the list, but they're there in England, and maybe they're an easy next door call. But whoever the scheduled group was for Top of the Pops dropped out. And they said, can you perform tomorrow?
First of all, that band, how do you not move heaven and earth to appear on Top of the Pops?
I don't know.
But for whatever reason, they didn't. And they called these guys and they were like, yes, we will be there.
Yep. And so it was George and Andrew, and they had two female singers with them that they took inspiration from Human League.
That's right.
And they were did. Like, we just like the look of two guys and two girls. It uh-huh. just is a good look. They literally developed their dance routine in George's parents' back room. No choreographer was there. There was no setup. It was, okay, guys, how about you do this and I do this and we do this together. Uh-huh. And that was it. Can you imagine being a 19-year-old kid about to go and debut on Top of the Pops?
Maybe the opportunity of a lifetime.
And once again, George is petrified and Andrew says, let's go do this. Uh-huh. He's confident. He's ready to go. And George goes out there and plays the part. He gets up and he dances and goes crazy. And it is literally an overnight success for them.
They shoot up the charts.
Yes. And now it's, oh, we're stuck in this contract with Intervision.
Right.
They bring on a new manager who gets them out of that contract, signs with CBS Records, and they come out with their first album called Fantastic.
By the way, the night before they played Top of the Pops, they stayed in this crappy little hotel room, and there was a child's bed.
Oh, yeah.
And they had to draw, like, who gets the child's bed? Well, George got it.
Short pizza crust.
That's right. So the night before he performs on Top of the Pops, he sleeps in a miniature bed.
Yes. He's shaking his hips around like he's trying to relieve some sort of lower back pain, I think.
Right.
So they re-release Wham! Rap, and it moves up to number 8 now.
It does, yep.
And they have a couple of other good hits off of Fantastic, and they're recognized because, number one, they're white guys doing rap, and number two, they're doing it with a social conscience. Like, their songs are about what it's like in England for the youth those days. At that point, 16 to 19-year-olds had the biggest unemployment rate that they had ever had in UK history, and so that was part of what they sang about, among other things. And so they're being recognized for kind of doing this cutting-edge style of music,
right,
and a social commentary. And so what does George Michael do? Well, what we've learned through history he always does, he says, I'm tired of being placed in this box. I would like to put myself in another box. And they come out with this song called Club Tropicana.
Have you seen this video?
I have seen parts of it, yes.
It looks like the greatest time that two 20-year-olds could have.
I can't imagine. Like, I saw some of the celebrities that would stay there. I saw, like, Billy Dee Williams with Grace Jones, and I'm just like, if you had the means to go to this place, this is where you would go all the time.
So this video was shot at Ibiza in Spain, which is like this resort town. It's like Miami, really.
Yeah.
Sun-drenched, babes, drinks, pools, everything you think would be a great weekend. It looks awesome.
Yeah. Then the press starts making fun of them. Or if you're from England, starts taking the piss out of them.
Right.
And so they're like, why are you guys making fun of us? We're 19-year-old kids. We're 20-year-old kids. How can you do this to us? And so I got to say this at this point. Looking back, I mean, especially with Wake Me Up.
Right.
There is a taint on that song. As much as anybody loves that song, they might call it a guilty pleasure. Right?
It's an embarrassment to say you really like that song.
But you know what? I am here. I mean, I literally had the same thought. Before as we moved away from Tears for Fears and Songs from the Big Chair, and I'm thinking, wow, this is a deep, awesome album. And we're moving on to Wham!
Oh,
Bubblegum,
yeah,
and Lollipops, right?
It'll make your teeth hurt.
I am here to advocate for the songwriting and the incredible talent that went behind this album that most consider to be sweet bubblegum popcorn crap.
I'm spiking the football with you. This is a great album of the 80s. These are great songs. I don't care what you say. They are infectious, catchy, wonderful pop songs.
Yep. So I think that brings us to song number one. Right out of the gate. Thank you, whoever decided the song order of this album. This song came from a mistake on a note from Andrew Ridgely to his mom. Wake me up before you go-go.
Wake me up before you go-go. Don't leave me hanging on like a yo-yo. Wake me up before you go-go. I don't want to miss it when you hit that.
This is a fantastic pop song.
Yeah, so tell us the story about the mistaken note.
Okay, so during Fantastic, they still weren't making any money because
right.
of that terrible record deal you talked about.
Yep.
So they're still living at their parents' house. Andrew Ridgely was there. He had to get up for some PR thing. He left a note for his mom taped to his door that said, wake me up before you go. And then he realized, oh, shoot, I made a mistake. I put up in there twice. And so as a joke to his mom, he finished it saying, go, go. So the note said, wake me up before you go, go. George saw the note, thought it was funny, took that, ran with it, and created this wonderful number one pop smash in 1984.
You put the gray skies out of my way. You make the sunshine brighter than Doris Day. Turn the bright spark into a flame.
Jason, you make the sunshine brighter than Doris Day.
Doris Day, we talked about in our 5 Minutes of Fire.
Yep.
So the interesting thing about this song was never demoed. George Michael had this song in his head and communicated it to the musicians, and they just pieced it together from his brain directly to the album. That's amazing.
It is fantastic. He has such an incredible voice and such an incredible ability with music that he can convey the right notes so that anybody who knows what they're doing with an instrument should be able to do what he's doing.
It's an amazing ability that he has. The talent as a musician is incredible. Okay, at the beginning of the song, they say the word jitterbug a couple of times.
Yes.
Jitterbug is a dance craze from the 1930s.
Yes.
Do you know how to do the jitterbug?
I do not.
I don't either. But he wanted to make a very energetic pop record that was like from the 50s or 60s.
This is an upbeat pop song at the time that punk rock was in its heyday. I mean, if we think about the British music scene, punk rock was making a big splash, and what they did in reaction to that was to go, hey, we're going to do something that's a throwback to 50s style music, mentioning dance styles from the 30s.
Right.
And Doris Day and Sunshine and Lollipops.
I watched some reaction videos to people watching this for the first time, and they were smiling and laughing and toe-tapping. It's an infectious, it's just fun. This song was released in May of 1984, hits number one, November of 1984. Let me say that one more time. Let me get ready for this. Number one hit. I'm going to say that a few more times on this album, okay?
Yes.
Real quick, trivia question for you. What song blocked Purple Rain from becoming a number one hit?
I'm going to go with Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
I know that when we talked about that, I laughed and shook my head at that. I would like to apologize, public apology. This song has lasting power. People are still listening to it today.
I played it for my daughter last night. She knew every word. She's 15. Okay? Yeah. Here's the other thing. D, if I told you, let's make a list of 10 songs that are the most 80s. I'm not saying the best, the most 80s songs. If you put this song on there, I got no problem with it.
Nobody's going to argue with it.
Put Careless Whisper on that list, I got no problem with it.
Nope.
Let's talk about the video for a second.
Okay.
This video was directed by our man, Andy Moorhan.
Cool.
You've got black lights, you've got a crowd, you've got the Choose Life t-shirts, you've got the goofy yellow fingerless gloves and the pink shirts and weird hats, and they're dancing, they've got horns, and they are having a blast.
If you watch this video and you're not happier at the end than you were at the beginning, you need to go see somebody.
That's right. That's right. Those horns and his voice and that chorus, I defy you not to smile and tap your toe.
It's truly infectious, and I shall not scoff again.
You know, here's the other interesting thing.
Yeah.
George Michael had since turned his back on this song.
Oh, of course.
He called it naff and stupid. He would do that with lots of songs. He did that with Careless Whisper. He did that with I Want Your Sex. It's like he, as soon as they were out of his brain, he outgrew them.
It was a perfectionist type of reaction to much of what he did, because once it's down and it's permanently placed, a perfectionist will still pick apart whatever they've done, and then they have to, that is their reason for hating it later on. But his perfectionism is what made all of the beautiful music that came.
It's true. All right, let's move on to the next number one single on the album. This song is called Everything She Wants.
So listening to the little opening part of this song, beat and the synthesizer, I want you to think about when you had a Casio keyboard in the mid 80s, right?
Right.
Because everybody did, right?
Yeah.
And they all had those kind of pre-programmed beats, sure, and pre-programmed songs. Well, George Michael had one too. Okay. I don't know if it's a Casio, but he had a little synthesizer with a pre-programmed beat. And he said that this is the one song that he had started with the backing track first.
Okay.
Normally he would write the melody first and then figure out the rhythm later. This is an AI song. This is a computer generated beat that he used and then developed the rest of the song afterwards. And what's great is, you want to talk about some meaningful lyrics. This isn't hippy dippy love.
Oh yeah.
This is a guy who, they warned him, everything she wants is everything she sees.
Yeah.
But still, he falls in love, he gets married, and sure enough, everything she wants is everything she needs, and that's all, I'm spending all of my money. Oh, and now we're having a baby. And now you tell me that you're having my baby. I supposed to support a baby? Should I act like I'm happy?
Yeah. This is heartbreaking, right? Every time I would watch this video on MTV, I'm like, he doesn't even think he loves her. And he's having a baby. Uh-huh. And his back is going to break if she asks him to do one more thing.
Yep.
It's a bummer of a deal. A guy's married. Oh, I don't love this girl anymore. Oh, we're having a baby. Great.
Yeah.
Just what I needed.
It's not an uncommon theme. Now, it's not certainly something that George ever actually went through, but it is certainly a interesting plot line to go with.
Especially from a 21, 22-year-old.
Yeah, let's think about that. George Michael was born in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
That means when he was writing this song, he was at most 20 years old.
That's true. That's true. This song was written and produced by George Michael. He said when he finished this song, even though it was credited as Wham, he did everything. That's when he realized, think I can pull this off by myself.
Yeah. This is their sophomore album. They had Fantastic, they had this, and then they have one more album that they are already calling the final. Album number 3, they already knew that it was over, that this was a temporary project. This was not something that was supposed to grow old. Even Andrew Ridgely said, Wham would never be middle-aged.
You know, Andrew Ridgely is incredibly gracious throughout this entire deal. We'll talk about more his role and how that changed over the years. You know, I mean, he was the leader. He was the leader that George aspired to.
Yeah.
And then they switched positions and George kept going.
Yeah.
Like a rocket.
Well, here's the thing. Andrew Ridgely wanted to be a rock star, and George Michael wanted to be a musician, right?
Well, both, check.
Right, absolutely. Uh-huh. And so Ridgely was the guy who was making the tabloids of all of the sexcapades that he would get involved in, which is exactly what
Randy
he wanted.
Andy.
That, exactly. That's what he wanted. He wanted that rock star lifestyle. I genuinely don't think he had the aspiration to do more with his music career. Like, I felt sorry for him initially. I was thinking, you know, poor guy, he mentors George Michael. He brings him up. He makes him a member, you know, talks him into forming this band, all this stuff. And then George Michael just kind of leaves him behind. But I mean, I had to look it up. Andrew Ridgely's net worth is $40 million. He's not suffering.
Wow.
And after this, he did race cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he
did whatever he wanted to.
He married the girl from Bananarama.
The hottest girl in Bananarama.
Whoever he wanted, if you will.
That's it. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. And here's the other thing. Andrew Ridgely strikes me as being a much happier individual, despite the end of his success, basically, in 1986.
The end of his fame. That's really what it was.
Sure.
It was the end of his fame. But that, again, he wanted that fame for the time that he was young, and then he knew he wanted to move on to other things. He wanted to have diverse interests, and it goes to his self-confidence in who he was. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I did this rock star thing, and now I'm going to do this race car thing, and now I'm going to be this professional cyclist. And
he seems to me very well adjusted, very comfortable in being worth $40 million. George always seemed to struggle with happiness, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I will tell you this. This Everything She Wants was George Michael's favorite Wham song. This is one of the only songs that he would play during the Faith years. He shied away from most of his Wham stuff. And he was also known, you know, like you said, he was a perfectionist. So he would hang around for the editing of the videos. In this case, he helped Andy Moorhan edit this particular video.
Yeah. So tell me about this video.
Okay. So it's black and white. Got some concert footage. Of course, you've got George's mug right there, big right there in screen.
That's what every 18-year-old girl wanted to see at that point.
Yeah, and it's a whole lot less happy than Wake Me Up Before You Go.
It is not a happy subject at all.
I will tell you this. This song hit number one, May 25th, 1985. Would you like to hear the top 7 that week?
You know I would.
Okay, because it's loaded with Shirley stuff, okay?
Okay, yeah.
Number 7 that week, May 25th, 1985. Number 7, One Night in Bangkok.
Go check out our Patreon page, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to join our Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/surelypodcast. And we cover One Hit Wonders exclusively for our Patreon members, as little as $5 a month. If you don't like what we've got, and you get access to all of the episodes. If you don't like it, we'll give you your money back, and happy to do so.
We've got some great episodes over there, including the one on One Night in Bangkok.
Yep.
Number 6, Crazy for You by Madonna.
Madonna keeps coming up. I feel like we need to cover her.
We need to cover her at some point. Number 5, Smooth Operator by Sade.
Sade.
Number 4, Axel F.
Okay. Yeah, we just covered that one in our Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack.
Yep. Number 3, Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
covered that last week. Yeah. Right.
Number two, Don't You Forget About Me from The Breakfast Club.
That was another Patreon episode. Great episode.
Yep. And then number one, Everything She Wants. Did you know? See, this stat blew me away. When this song hit number one, it became the first album to have three number one singles since the Bee Gees did it.
That's impressive.
Faith, I think, had four number one.
What album did the Bee Gees get it with?
I think they got it with Saturday Night Fever.
Go back and check out that episode as well, because we covered that soundtrack versus the Dirty Dancing soundtrack after doing that movie versus the Dirty Dancing movie.
Some of my favorite episodes.
Oh, they're great.
Okay, we done with Everything She Wants?
Time to move on to song number three.
The song is called Heartbeat.
Now, we talked about this album being influenced by the 60s. This beat is straight out of Leader of the Pack by the Shangri-Las.
Oh, okay.
Now, I texted you when I heard this because this is my first time going through this album since I was, you know,
12.
Yeah. No, try it, 8.
Okay.
Yeah. But the melody, the little riff at the beginning, it sounds like My Hometown by Bruce Springsteen, which, of course, just came out the year before.
I can hear that. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So you got the 64 Shangri-La, you know, three-girl music group beat going with that melody, but it's still a catchy little tune. Until I saw you. Heartbeat, heartbeat, why do you bear me now? Oh, you hurt me, desert me in my darkest hour.
I think this could have been a successful single. This is one that, if they chose to release it with the Wham mania going on at the time, I have no doubt this could have been a great single, great song, successful charting single.
So this song, he's sitting at the end of summer vacation, watching his friends go by, hearing the school bell rings, thinking about the happy little kisses he shared with some girl until he sees another girl. And he's then stuck, like, oh my gosh, I have this desire for her, but I have this obligation to my current girlfriend, which, of course, that topic comes up a little bit later on with Careless Whisper. He says, how could I help but admire her beauty standing on the line between desire and duty?
He had a restless heart.
Yeah.
He wasn't a long-term guy with anybody. Kind of known for cruising.
Just ask Brooke Shields.
That's right. That's right. Okay, I got a great story for you.
Okay, yeah, I'm here.
I'm going to throw it in here, okay? So this album was recorded at Studio Merival in the south of France, like June and July of 1984.
Yeah. Okay. Life must be hard.
Right, I know,
South
right?
France in the summer.
Feel terrible July. For them. That actually is one of the studios where Pink Floyd put the finishing touches on The Wall.
Yep.
Okay. They come into the recording studio one day, and there's a message for them. They got a phone call from Sir Elton John. He wants to invite them to a bit of lunch. Andrew Ridgeley's like, that's when we knew we're big time. He talked about how when they would hang out in George's room when they were kids and talk about music and look at albums and stuff, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was one of their favorites.
Absolutely.
And so they got to hang out with Elton John, and they were on his boat and having lunch. One of the funny things that they did, of course, they're 20 or 21, whatever they are. They cruised by a boat where Joan Collins was supposed to be. That was her boat. And so George yelled at the boat, hey, Joan, show us your knickers. So south of France for a couple of 20-year-olds who are successful.
On a yacht and, with Elton John. Yeah, Elton John actually was one of the first big recording artists that came forward and said, George Michael is an incredibly talented songwriter. And I mean, he's saying that from the songs off of Make It Big. He's talking about Faith. He's talking about Make It Big and Fantastic. And he says, this is a guy who's truly gifted. And I don't see that very often anymore. And just to kind of add credit to what Elton's saying, he won the award that year for Best New Songwriter. That was the thing that actually, the award that actually made George Michael weep on stage, because he was presented with the award by Elton John. He's surrounded by all of his heroes, songwriting heroes, and he felt like with this album, they were in teen magazines, right? They're there with their shirts off and tan, and they have the screaming girls, and It's that rock star side of things. And he understood that recognition and probably didn't even like it that much. But once he was recognized for his songwriting abilities, that's what really made him feel like he was worth something.
So just to recap, Elton John says, they're awesome. George's dad says, you suck. Yeah. Until later.
Until later.
He yes. does come around.
He does.
Let's give him credit where it's due. Okay, next song on the album is called Like a Baby.
Okay, so this is the song where you have the action scene in the movie and everybody's chasing each other and there's gunfire and then they have to get onto the elevator and all of a sudden it's just waiting awkwardly for a minute and a half.
Yeah.
What? I was like, is this an instrumental? Is this Muzak? What am I listening to here? This is easy, smooth jazz from a different genre of music than I thought I was listening to.
This belongs on Cinemax After Dark.
Maybe that too.
I'm telling you, it's soft, it's smooth, it's jazzy, but it does nothing for me.
Yeah. And then, I mean, it's a full minute and 40 seconds into the song, and then all of a sudden George starts singing. Oh, guess it's not a musical.
Right.
And to be honest, as far as the songwriting goes for this album, this is bottom of my list.
This is the low
this
point.
This is kind of plain vanilla love song, not terribly interesting stuff to me.
Yep.
So we're in agreement this if there is a skipper on the album, this one's it.
This is it.
Okay.
This is it.
Hit stop on your tape player.
Kick it out. Flip it over for side two. And we start off with Freedom.
You told me this was a remake of a Supremes song from the 60s, I would say, yeah, I could see that.
I could see that.
It is completely by that playbook. This is Motown all over the place, except we got a white, blonde, British guy singing.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a great pop song.
Oh, it's excellent. This is one of the best on the album.
The bridge is great. The chorus is great. It's sing-along. Another toe-tapper. This is Wham encapsulated in 3 minutes.
This song was released on October 1st, 1984.
In the UK.
In the UK.
Released in August of 85 in the US.
Did it make it to number one?
It made it to number three.
What?
Made it to number three.
I know you're going to tell me the two that kept it out of the one number one spot.
Let's do the top five.
Okay.
So this is September 28th, 1985, where it peaks out at number three. Number five, Oh Sheila by Ready for the World.
That is one that I have suggested for our one-hit wonder episodes on Patreon, yes.
Number four, Don't Forget My Number by Phil Collins. Great
Phil
song.
Phil Collins is always going to be out there.
We are covering Phil Collins next summer.
Yep.
Number three, Freedom. Number two, Cherish by Kool and the Gang.
Okay, that's not bad. I don't know that it's better than Freedom,
right,
but it's not bad.
Number one, Money for Nothing by Dire Straits.
Oh, that one's a winner. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not knocking that one out.
No, that's, yeah. The beautiful combination of Mark Knopfler and Sting and a killer guitar riff. Yeah.
And a fantastic music video.
Yeah. Checks all the boxes.
Yep. So Freedom was written when George was 19. After he was done, he was thrilled. He said, I cannot believe I just did that. That was the moment that he started to take himself seriously as a songwriter.
I heard him talk about his songwriting, and he said that when he does a song well, it doesn't feel like he's written the song. It feels like he has discovered it, like that the song already exists, and he's just found it. Like it's out there, and he's just found it.
I mean, how can you argue with a guy who every time they put out a single, it's, in this album, nothing outside of the top three. Three number ones and a number three?
Yeah, four releases, and a little bit of a story later on that year after this album has been released, he says to himself, I'm going to get fourth number one single in this year.
Right.
And writes another song
that
and
hits
almost makes it
number two. The despite being one of the greatest Christmas songs of all time.
Well, it did ultimately become number one in 2020.
That
4 years, almost exactly 4 years after he passes away.
That's the other Wham song that she knows.
Last Christmas, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is what we're talking about.
That's right. That's right. Which he said they were watching a football game, soccer, to you and me.
Yeah.
And Andrew said that George just disappeared for like an hour.
Said he suddenly sat up, bolt upright is the words he used. Bolts up out of the chair. I got
to
go.
Comes back an hour later, says, Andy, you got to come listen to this.
He's got a little four-track recorder that you put your regular old Maxwell cassette tape into, and it's Last Christmas.
Incredible.
Incredible. By the way, before we get off of Last Christmas, yeah, the song that kept it out of the number one spot.
Do They Know It's Christmas by Band-Aid or whatever.
Which George Michael sang on.
But, you know, it drove him freaking insane that it never got to number one.
He said he had two little voices in his head. One was very happy that this charitable work that he had done was doing so well. And the other one was saying, I don't know if this was a truly charitable concept or if they hoped that maybe the fact that they added the charity to it might push it into the number one spot. But all of the proceeds from Last Christmas were donated to charity.
Yeah, he really wanted that fourth number one. Luckily, Faith came along a couple of years later, and he took care of that.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of Faith, there is an organ at the very beginning of the song Faith, which we talked about in our Faith episode. That organ is playing the chorus from Freedom.
Check out that episode. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Let's talk about the music video for a second.
Okay.
We did talk about this at length during our Faith episode, but it was shot in China, which at the time, that was the first time a Western act had ever been invited to China to perform. And so there's some really great shots there, them at the Great Wall. And I remember at the time we talked about how the organizers for this event, they went to the Chinese officials and they said, okay, here's your choices. Queen. And they showed some like unflattering pictures of Freddie Mercury or, you know, these two wholesome young men right here. And the Chinese guys are like, we'll take this people right here. Wham. So music video, they're all over China. They're doing things. They're at the Great Wall of China. There's a great shot of them playing a boombox to like a bunch of older people. And they're playing Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
So with this song, not in China, but in Japan, they did an advertisement. I don't even know what the advertisement was for, but it was great because I saw a video and it's George Michael and Andrew Ridgely. And this has to be very close to right before George passed away. I mean, they're both obviously in their 50s.
They're gray. And
Yeah. And they talk about how, number one, they start off the video doing a bad moonwalk like Simon Le Bon did. And then they change the words to Freedom. And it goes like this.
Doesn't matter that you're slightly porky.
Dorky.
That's good. I love it.
Yep.
Number three hit. For those keeping score at home, that's two number ones and a number three with one more to go.
Yeah. And a mention of a number two in there, by the way. Not off this album, but same year.
That's right. Yep. That's right. Okay. Moving on to the next song.
Let's do it.
Next song is called If You Were There. What do you think?
Kind of sounds like the beginning of an 80s sitcom.
One called If You Were There?
Yeah.
This is a cover.
Yeah?
This is a cover from the 1973 song by the Isley Brothers.
Okay.
That's why it sounds slightly disco-y.
I guess. It sounds very 80s to me, which I don't think that most of the songs, I mean, other than that they defined the 80s. At the time that this album came out, Freedom, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, Everything She Wants, all of those songs, they set the standard. This one, to me, imitates the standard, and I don't, I mean, it's okay. It sounds like a filler song to me.
I told you that of the songs on this album, they either transcend time and space or they're just kind of bleh.
Yeah.
This is one of those songs I'm just like, eh.
Yeah.
Skipping?
I'm moving on.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up, song called Credit Card Baby.
Great. We're back to the Motown. I'm happy. You know, this isn't the Supremes. This is the Four Tops, right? This is Sugar Pie, Honey Bunch, whatever you like. I can't help myself. They deliver when they throw back to that 60s style.
This is the happy version of everything she wants. He doesn't trust women, clearly, because all they want him for is his money.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to play you a song that I think this sounds exactly alike.
Okay. It's doing it all for my baby, Huey Lewis. Knew it as soon as I heard it. But again, they are both imitating the style of the Four Tops from 1965 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But doo-wop, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
It's great. I love it.
Okay, I got the story behind this song.
Okay, yeah, I'm excited.
So here you go. Who is this song about, right? Huh? Who is the credit card baby? Huh? So basically, George had three girlfriends in his entire life. Like serious girlfriends, right?
Okay, yeah.
He had a bunch of women he was with, whatever.
Right.
A bunch of guys too, but three serious girlfriends, okay? One is Brooke Shields, okay? One is Kathy Young. She's the girl that he wrote Explore Monogamy on her back for the...
Oh, right, right, yeah.
I Want Your Sex video, right?
Right. Japanese girl, right?
Smoking.
Yeah.
Smoking hot.
Yeah.
And this other girl named Pat Fernandez. Most people think this song's about Pat Fernandez.
Okay. She looks like the middle sister on The Cosby Show.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Miss Bledsoe.
Yeah.
Yep. This is from a guy who could bed literally anyone in the world in 1985.
Like I said, I don't know why you're limiting it to women.
Once again, you're correct, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. Fun song. Not great.
Oh, I like it.
You like it?
Yeah. This is a top half of the album for me.
Okay.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, that's fair enough. Let's get to the big hitter.
Okay, last song on the album. Before I get started on the song, do you know who Joshua Redick is?
No.
He's a baseball player.
Okay.
Played, I think he started with the Boston Red Sox, would kind of go in and out of the majors and minors, never really kind of found himself until 2013. He's by this time with the Oakland A's. He's not doing real hot. And then one game, August of 2013, he hits three home runs in one game. And suddenly his career takes off. Like, he becomes unstoppable. And by February of the next year, 2014, he's signed a multi-million dollar contract, $2 million and something, with the Oakland A's. And 3 months later, they say, hey, you are batting like a phenom. What would you like your coming up to bat intro, I'm going to kick some butt song to be?
Right.
And he picks song number 8 off of Make It Big, song we like to call Careless Whisper. Can you imagine walking up to the plate with the sax solo playing?
Hey, if you believe it's because of a song or you're breathing out of your eyelids, it doesn't matter.
Well, all I can say is the guy's career skyrocketed after that. Like, it was a $4 million, then a $6 million next year, and then like a $50 million for the next 4 years. I mean, he really took off, and I would say that it's in no small part due to the magic of this song.
This is a 80s masterpiece.
So I gave a big, long story. When we covered Faith back in our very first season, I gave a big, long story about the story behind the song that I had actually heard George Michael talk about in an interview. Mm-hmm. And he had a girl that he fell in love with at the skating rink when he would chaperone his older sister at the skating rink. There's a girl.
Jane,
yes, that he fell in love with. And he then, you know, they go on their separate ways. Nothing ever happens with that romance. But then he starts dating a girl named Helen. And then happens, stance be what it is, he comes across Jane again. And suddenly Jane is infatuated with him. And now it's this awkward situation where he's with Helen, but he's got all of those old feelings about Jane. Now, researching this album again for this episode, what I understand is that's a bunch of horseshit.
Okay.
Which is tragic because it's a great story.
It is a great story.
But here is the true part of the story. Here is the part of the story that has remained consistent throughout. At 17 years old, the young, yet-to-be-named George Michael, gets on a bus, public transit, walks onto the bus, and as he is handing his ticket or money to the bus driver, this melody goes into his head. And that night, he goes and finds a friend who plays the saxophone, records him playing the saxophone, and it all develops this song.
The original demo for this was created in 1981 in the Ridgely's home. But it doesn't really ever fit any album until Make It Big comes along.
When George and Andrew first got together as a band, they had a demo tape, which was essentially this completed song, a half song, and like the first two chords of another song that they were thinking about.
Right.
And they would go from record company to record company saying, listen to our demo, listen to our demo. And every time they were thrown out. But guess what? Every single one of those record companies heard Careless Whisper and said, no thanks. Come back when you can write a hit.
Oh my gosh, it's so incredible, right? It's the biggest selling single of 1985, and they had no clue. But you can actually see the evolution of the song.
But then they don't put it on Fantastic.
Andrew originally said, just didn't feel right for the tone of the album.
But it does feel right for the tone of this album.
So their manager says, hey, I got a great idea. Why don't you go to the studio, Muscle Shoals in Alabama, where Aretha Franklin recorded Respect?
Yeah, they're working with Jerry Wexler, who did Aretha Franklin's Respect, who did Ray Charles songs. I mean, he was icon.
He's a legend.
George flies from the UK down to Alabama to play with the Swampers.
Yeah. He said that when he was recording the song, Jerry Wexler would be like, all right, George, whenever you're ready. By the way, that's the microphone that Aretha Franklin used to sing Respect into. So it was all this pressure.
Yeah.
And he said that everybody there was the best of the best. But after listening to it, he didn't feel like it had any kind of soul.
Let's listen to that version here. Right.
It's bland. It doesn't have the magic.
Yeah. So when he got back to the UK with the tape, Andrew's like excited, you know? I would be excited if my buddy had just flown across the country,
right,
across the world to work with the best musicians in the business, the best producer in the business in this iconic studio. And he says, how is it? How did it go? What does it sound like? And George just says, tell me what you think. And just puts the tape in. Both listen to it, and Andrew says, I feel like they took all of the edge off.
Yeah.
And George said, I feel exactly the same way. Now, at this point, as this young and yet to be super famous guy, do you go with Jerry Wexler and the Swampers,
right,
or do you put your foot down and say, let's re-record it my way?
He had the gumption to say, this is not right. This is not what I want. Thank you, Jerry Wexler. I'll do it myself.
Yeah.
So he goes back into the studio. And he brings in 10 different saxophone players and fires 10 saxophone players.
Yeah. We talked in our Faith episode about how in any normal situation, you take a session musician who knows what he's doing. And this is a thing where he arrives at 11 and is done by 1 o'clock.
Right.
No. He brings that guy in and he plays all afternoon. And George says, that's not it. That's not it. Fire that guy, bring in the next guy. And then they do it 9 more times. And then finally, and this is, again, serendipity.
Yep.
They bring in Steve Gregory. Steve Gregory, phenomenal saxophonist, knows his craft. But you have this brief little moment where luck shines. And George, who's the one who's nixed every single sax solo they've done so far, leaves the studio. And Steve says, it's a little tough to get all these notes in this short span here. What if I lower the key that this is in and play it slower, and then you speed it up to match the right pitch and the right tempo? That's exactly what they do. They do it before George gets back, and they have it recorded. And when he walks in the door, they play it for him, and he says, that's it. That's the sound that I want. It's the blast. It's the blast that you get in some of those notes that's missing from that Muscle Shoals version that makes this sax solo in the top echelon of sax solos as far as songs. I mean, Baker Street level.
It's magical. It's magical. The other part that we kind of bypassed, Andrew gets writer credit on this.
They worked together on it when they were 17.
Well, a lot of people have said this was George's sort of last gift to Andrew, splitting the proceeds, splitting the writing of the song so that he could get a big payday. Andrew is adamant. Listen, I wrote some of the chords in this song, brought it to Yogg, and he said, those chords go perfectly with this sax solo I've got in my head. So it really was written by the two of them.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a part in the song at the end where it goes next level. Tonight the music seems so loud. I wish that we could lose this crowd. Maybe it's the part when he says, tonight the music seems so loud. Wish that we could lose this crowd. And he's really belting it out with passion. You know, the please stay, the begging part of it. Next level.
He brings the emotion to those lyrics probably better than any other song that he's done in Miami.
Let's talk about the music video for a second.
Okay.
So originally this was shot in Miami Beach. I've got a picture of them at the hotel, the Holiday Inn in Miami.
The Holiday
Inn. Where they stayed while they filmed the video for this.
George walking around in a towel.
Yeah, it was. That's exactly right. But shot in Miami. He did not like the way his hair looked. I think I told you this. So his hair is dark. It doesn't have that bleach blonde look in this. It's dark. So he calls his sister in London, who's a hairstylist. They fly her out to Miami at the cost of £10,000 so she can come and cut and fix and style his hair. And that's why when you watch the music video, there's kind of two pieces. You have the Miami footage and you have the when he's in the sort of the theater with the chains hanging from the ceiling. His hair is blonde. In those shots.
Yeah.
So, and that's the reason why.
The director of the video is a guy named Duncan Gibbons. He was working for a company called John Roseman Productions. Well, John Roseman had something to say about the making of the video. He called it a f***ing disaster.
Right.
Part of that because George was being so prima donna about his hair.
Yeah.
And then part of it just because it was just dumb. It didn't make any sense with what was going on lyrically in the song. And so that's why you have that second half that is shot by Moran.
Yeah, definitely. I did see somewhere where somebody said that, you know, he went through all this trouble to make his hair look good. And all it ended up doing was looking like Princess Diana.
By the way, I don't know if we mentioned it, but Moran is the guy who also directed I Want Your Sex, Faith, and Father Figure.
By the way, this song hits number one, February 16th. 1985.
That is three, for those of you who are keeping track, boys and girls, three number one hits, four top three hits, and one extra for the year that still got to number two.
That's right.
So when this single was released, George Michael dedicated the song to his parents. Now, we talked about how his father told him he couldn't sing, expected him to go be a doctor or an accountant or help out with the restaurant.
Right.
Did not expect him to make it. But at some point, when they are big with this tour, he goes to see him in concert and sees an arena full of people screaming and crying and singing along with his son. And he says, "I wept like a baby. I did a complete U-turn. I said, I was wrong. You were right. You were gifted, and I'm sorry." So in the liner notes, dedicated to his parents, says it was 5 minutes in return for 21 years.
Okay. I'm glad that his dad saw the light. I mean, how could you not acknowledge talent there? I mean, it's on display for the world to see that your son is one of the greatest, most gifted singer-songwriters of his era.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier there that with this song, they released it as Wham! Featuring George Michael.
Yeah.
Or just George Michael, which was a little unusual given that this was just their second album. But like I said, I feel like these guys had an idea of what Wham! Was going to be, and it was not going to be something that lasted.
It's interesting, the sort of agreement that they have on this. Obviously, they're prepping George for his solo career, but Andrew did write this song as well. So Andrew's just an incredibly gracious guy. He saw George's talent, he saw where he was going, and he got out of the way.
Yeah, 100%. And if you watch the final concert, like the final of the final, they come out with a third album that was really their goodbye album, mm-hmm. and they do the final show of the final tour, these guys couldn't be getting along any better. Like, there's literally no hostility that they have towards each other. They're not acrimonious at all. They love each other. They are best friends, and they knew that it was just time for this phase of their lives to be over.
When he hugged Andrew at the end of that last show in June of 1986, they had that huge concert, Wembley Arena. He hugged him and said, "Andrew, I could not have done this without you." That, to me, Andrew is happy to go off into the sunset and wish George the best. And of course, George goes on to sell 120 million albums worldwide from that point forward and puts himself in the echelon of the Princes and the Michael Jacksons and the Madonnas of the 80s.
So I don't want to leave the song without talking about the Seether cover.
Okay.
This is actually a really great cover. And Seether is this South African band that is a very hardcore band, but they do a great job with the song. They got asked to do a Valentine's Day song, and they thought, this is so ridiculous. Let's do something crazy like a Wham! Song. They do it, and it becomes a big hit for them. And so they're touring with Nickelback, which we'll be covering later on.
Let's go.
Who do you hate more, Nickelback or Creed? We will be covering those two bands later on this summer.
Ready for it.
And they're touring with Nickelback, and they say the younger kids in the crowd are like singing along because they think it's a Seether song. They don't know about Wham. And then you've got the older guys who are there for the hard rock who are like giving them the finger and throwing bottles at them because they think they're, I don't know, some homophobia thing or something. I don't know.
That's funny. Yeah. All right. Are we ready for Final Judgment?
Boys and girls, it is that time. We have covered both of these albums. They are both incredible albums. They're both big, if you will.
They are big.
Songs from the big chair and make it big. Yes, it's time for Final Judgment. I nominate Jason Colvin to speak first.
Okay, so for me, I'm a pop guy. Always been a pop guy. I love rock as well. These are two great mid-80s sort of pop rock albums. I would say that I love Make It Big more than most. The Good Hooks, Good Looks formula worked on me as a kid. I thought these guys were cool. Thought they put out great music. I thought it was a lot of fun. I was all in. Had this tape. Loved it. But the Tears for Fears album is better. It speaks to my soul more. It's a little more serious. Although I tend to be more happy-go-lucky and less serious. I can't deny the Head Over Heels, the Everybody Wants to Rule the World, Shout, Mother's Talk. For me, Spiking the Football, Tears for Fears, Songs from the Big Chair, it's the better of these two albums.
Yeah. When we got done with Tears for Fears, I was thinking to myself, this is going to be a landslide for Tears for Fears.
Yeah.
I didn't have high aspirations for Make It Big. I was at that moment that I hadn't yet studied it, I was thinking bubblegum pop.
Right,
which I thought you would land both feet into.
It was close, yeah.
But upon going through the album, rediscovering some of these songs, looking at the lyrics of these songs in more detail, Make It Big is a high quality album. It has feel good component that is kind of missing from Tears for Fears.
No doubt.
Songs from the Big Chair. And so I think of it, I think of these two albums very much in the same way when we did our Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA versus Huey Lewis in the News Sports. If I'm going to the beach and it's sunny and I want to put the top down and crank up the volume, I'm bringing Huey Lewis in the News. If I've just had a fight with my spouse or, you know, somebody just wrecked their car into my car in the parking lot and I'm angry and it's nighttime, I want to listen to Bruce Springsteen, right?
Sure.
So Tears for Fears is my angry drive music or maybe my sad drive music.
Right.
And Wham is my happy-go-lucky, let's go to the beach and have some fun and kick a volleyball around. So any, depending on the day, one of the other of these albums is going to be number one for me. But overall, looking at the entire album, because they both have huge banger songs off of them.
Right.
I can't find filler songs in Songs from the Big Chair. I can in Make It Big. The filler songs are skippers, and I didn't have any skippers on Songs from the Big Chair. And like I said, Songs from the Big Chair was like that girl from high school that you kind of disregarded and then fell in love with when you saw her again 40 years later. So I have to agree with you. Songs from the Big Chair is the better of these two albums, but dang, it is a much closer race than I thought it was.
That is awesome. I love it. You chose George Michael in the NXS battle.
I did.
I think George Michael's got his hooks into you a little bit.
He does. Yeah. He was truly a gifted musician.
One of the truly best. Gifted.
I didn't realize he had passed away on Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
2016.
Yep.
All right, that does it for this matchup. Next week, we have got another stellar matchup.
We are doing a What the Heck Happened between Jaws 3 and Beverly Hills Cop 3 with our good buddy Jeff Johnson from the Film By Podcast.
I just want you to know, you are to blame for the fact that I just spent $6.99 to buy a Blu-ray disc of Jaws 3,
yes,
which we left before it was over in the theater 41 years ago.
Okay, listen, we covered Jaws in season 1. The Film By guys, they covered Jaws 2 during their 1978 thing. We both did Jaws 4 with them together in a What the Heck Happened thing. We can't just not do Jaws 3.
We could.
But we're not. Come back next week for our discussion on that.
Guys, if you have listened this far, please just show us a little bit of love. You don't even have to spend money. Just hit the 5-star on whatever app you're using to listen to this podcast. If you leave a review, that helps get us up in the rankings so that more people see us. So if you love us, the best thing is to tell other people about us. The second best thing is to join our Patreon family because that's freaking fantastic. And then if you got nothing else to do, just give us a little 5-star and a review.
You know what our marketing budget is?
$0. You're listening to it right now.
That's right. So you know who we rely on to share the word? People like yourselves.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
We will see you next week for Jaws 3 versus Beverly Hills Cop 3. What the heck happened? You put the boom boom in my heart. Doo doo.
Jitterbug.
Where's my phone? Here we go.